Hi, everyone. Welcome to the sixth episode of the Svarim Chatter Shabbos Tzvi series. On this episode of the series, I spoke with Professor Alexander van der Haven, and we discussed Sarah Ashkenazi, who is Shabbos Tzvi's third wife and is messianic queen, so to speak. We discussed her impact, her life, her impact, and her place in the movement. Once again, I would like to thank the corporate sponsor of this series, Gluck Plumbing, for all your service needs. Big or small in New Jersey, with a full service division from boiler changeouts, main sewer line snakeouts, cameraing main lines to a simple faucet leak, Gluck Plumbing Service Division has you covered. Give them a call, 732-523-1836, extension 1. That's 732-523-1836, extension 1. And once again, if anybody would like to support the podcast, sponsor an episode, or for any questions, comments, or feedback, and thank you all that have given feedback on the series, please email me, svarimchatter@gmail.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast and another episode in the ongoing Shabbos Tzvi series. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Professor Alexander van der Haven, who is professor in the study of religion at the University of Bergen in Norway, and who wrote a small book entitled From Lowly Metaphor to Divine Flesh, Sarah the Ashkenazi, Sabbatai Tzvi's Messianic Queen and the Sabbatian Movement, which is about Sarah Ashkenazi, who was Shabbos Tzvi's, I guess, most famous wife, his third wife. And that's what we'll be discussing. So thank you, Professor van der Haven, for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start off. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
I grew up in the Netherlands. No particular background in Jewish studies, but I ended up in Jerusalem doing an MA there, where I researched the Jerusalem syndrome. So Sabbatai wasn't the first Messiah I encountered. And actually, I was able to interview some of them. And afterwards, I did a PhD at the University of Chicago. After that, I wrote this little book when I was at Webster University in St. Louis. I moved to Israel back again, where I mostly did research on conversion to Judaism in the Dutch Republic. And since the last already 2 years, in the pandemic, things go quickly, I've been in Norway, finally gotten my a real job back again. So I'm happily sitting here in the dark in Norway, far from other stuff.
So how did you become interested in Shabbatai Tzvi and Sabbatianism and the movement and come to write this book on Sarah Ashkenazi?
So it was when I actually was researching the Jerusalem syndrome. So when I was meeting people who claimed they were messiahs, prophets, and so I started like they also were doing. So all of these people were ferocious students of their predecessors, often also in competition. Especially Jesus was an important competition. So I have to be more important than Jesus, or I'm the return Jesus. So I started also reading up, and then of course there's no way around the other great messiah, or the other notorious messiah, or the other messianic disappointment in Jewish history, Shabbatai Tzvi. And of course, Gershom Sholem, that in the other podcast, he's already discussed many times, but he wrote this wonderful, readable, even though huge, his book is as big as mine is small, and also his knowledge is as large as mine is small. So I read and I loved also the way he described chapter 3. So since then I was kind of hooked on it. And when I after finished my dissertation, somebody asked me to we have some money to write about something about women and Judaism. So then of course the subject had offered itself, and I spent a romantic time with Sarah, the wife of Shabbatai Tzvi, and the little book came out as a result.
Yeah, and we'll discuss more about it, but the little book, as you mentioned, it was published in English originally, and it's now been redone into Hebrew, and yes, Perhaps will be redone in English. We'll get to that at the end. But who was Sarah Ashkenazi? Let's start off with her biography. I mean, who was she? I know, like you said, she's been mentioned, I think, on the other episodes of the series, but not as a focal point. Sholem doesn't focus on her, as you discuss in your book. So who was she? What's her story?
Yeah, so most stories of Sabbatianism leave her out, and the storyteller doesn't feel anything is lost. And one of the reasons, of course, and this is also a challenge of the writing of history, is she's an enigmatic figure. Like we do not know. So first of all, this is a gender issue. Women didn't write Lurianic tracts. They were not in the scene of the production of written material, except for, of course, a few notable exceptions like Luke of Hamlet. So she did not leave any writing, although I have been offered her autobiography, but I suspected that it was a fraud. So I made the mistake to say this. And so I could have gotten her autobiography, but I didn't. So she's a very enigmatic person. And also, as Shalom also writes, like the story of her life before she met Shabtai Tzvi is kind of, it's shrouded in mystery and exaggeration and myth making. And for him, this was a bit of a turn off. And for me, this was a turn on, because one of the things I realized is, well, if there's myths, somebody wants to tell a story. And what kind of story is this? So her life story is, and so we do not know much about it, but she was born in Poland, Ukraine. We don't know where. According to the story she was telling herself, she got separated from her father, so we don't know anything else of the other family, during the great massacres there. And so this is probably the Khmelnytsky massacre in 1648. She got separated from her father, and then there's different versions, but the oldest version, which of course doesn't mean it's the truest version, but she was as a child taken into a monastery, so a Christian monastery. And at some point she got a religious, not a vision, like her father, her dead father had died by then, came to her and basically like took her away from the monastery and also told her, you're going to marry the Messiah. Yeah. And he told her, you should go to Amsterdam where your brother is. So we don't know really what really happened. So let's assume that this did not really happen, what she was telling, but she was from Poland, Ukraine, separated from her family in the massacres, basically a refugee coming to the West. She was telling that she had been in several places in Germany, and she ended up in Amsterdam. So that's the first time we actually meet her as a person. So we have a memory of Jacob Sasportas, who meets her around 1655 in Amsterdam. And he says, like, she was a foolish young girl that claimed to be, that she was going to marry the Messiah. So already then she made this specific claim, like, I'm going to marry the Messiah. And also after writing the book, I did find, so it's not hard evidence, but at the, in this period, so like after 1648 and in the decade after, a number, because also consecutive massacres going on. So there were lots of refugees coming from the East, ending up in the big Jewish centers in Europe. And so Amsterdam, of course, was as one of the wealthiest and biggest Jewish communities. They got a lot of refugees, sometimes even by boats coming in. And so I tried to find any source about her, and I didn't find anything until and I find all the time found money that Jews were giving for basically for refugees to be given in a collective or to travel on to other places in Europe. But suddenly at some point there was a certain Sarah from Poland who got quite a bit of money. And I started to suspect this might be her, based on what we know, how good she was about with telling her story about being a refugee. So I think I have found her first footstep in the archives in the Netherlands. So in the Netherlands, so apparently Sasportas thought she was a fool, but other people she did impress. So we have the story of Lai Ben Oz that he wrote at the beginning of the next century, based on memories of people who actually met Sarah. And on them, she really did leave an impression. She even showed everybody. Apparently, her father had taken her on a nightly journey, and there were still the marks of his fingers on her arm. So she had the physical evidence. So she apparently made a huge impression on a number of Jews in the Netherlands, and also on somebody who she claimed and he claimed was her brother. So she did find her brother in the Netherlands, and I suspect it's a folia there, but there was somebody they kind of because you have to imagine, like, this is a refugee, and refugees, it's like today, you're in a survival mode. She had a really good story, and she ended up finding somebody who claimed to be her brother. So she was in the Netherlands for a few years, and then she left, and we don't know why. We don't know also exactly where she left it, but the next time she surfaces is in Italy. And in Italy, we have several new elements that come up in a story. First of all, she starts to have a promiscuous reputation. Yeah, so apparently she sleeps with all sorts of men. So that's the first thing that changes in Italy. She also is reputed to be able to see other people's lives. So she also develops these skills that other Kabbalists often have as well. So she has basically, she becomes a religious entrepreneur, and also is able to impress people. There also we know from Baruch of Arezzo that her story is different. So he tells a story that he apparently heard from her, or I forgot, like maybe also through others. I don't remember his specific situation when he was writing. But there she changes her story a little bit. Amsterdam disappears from the narrative. And her story is that she, again, was separated from her father, but rather than being taken into a monastery, she was actually taken by a Christian rich woman. And this woman wanted her to marry her son, and they would be extremely rich because she would give her her money. But of course, it was impossible to marry a Christian. So she is like, her father helped her escape. So they're like, you have a different story where it's like she's more the mature Sarah. She's a marriageable woman rather than like a small child taken up in a monastery. She also doesn't stay in Italy. She ends up, her next stage is in Cairo, where she meets our Messiah, and they marry. Yeah, and we still don't know exactly why they got married. Like, I think this is one of the things that you would ask. So one of the reasons, of course, is she had been claiming already for years that she was going to marry the Messiah. Shabtai Tzvi had some messianic issues. So this was basically a match made in heaven. So that's one of the reasons. Another reason that might also be important. So I don't know if we get to talk about this, but Shabtai Tzvi also had let's put it this way. He didn't seem to be very interested in women. So his first marriages ended in divorce because basically nothing had happened. And later also, after he married Sarah, he claimed that he was going to marry a prostitute, like Hosea was marrying a prostitute. So almost like to redeem, because the prostitute is Israel, so to redeem the deeply sinful person. So she basically almost had like a function of he was going to marry the fallen woman, as if he's like marrying fallen Israel to redeem Israel. So there's also, this could also be a reason. So we don't know. And many people don't know when they get married. And in this case, we also, so it might be a messianic marriage. It might be this specific notion that he wanted to marry a fallen woman and for the rest of deal with her. But this is how they ended up being married. Shall I go on with her life story? You want to move to something else?
No, continue on with the life story, and then we'll move on to other things after.
There's more to come. And so they married in 1663. So this is 2 years before Shabtai Tzvi declared himself Messiah, or at least like declared himself, but the first time was 1648, but it didn't really come out dramatically. like he was kicked out certain places, so it wasn't very successful. But the second time, 1665, was a big one. And then, of course, then he had also his messianic spouse at his side, so this might have helped. And of course, and I'm sure you discussed this in other podcasts, Nathan of Gaza was a great spokesman for the Messiah. But so at this point, so when he declares himself Messiah, like he has a wife who was destined to marry the Messiah, was also very symbolical of the Jews suffering in east of Europe. And so in a sense, he might also have been redeeming the suffering of the Jews in the north. So she might also have represented this. Yeah. So yes, they're married. And again, like I told you before, we were talking like this is like a decade ago, and I worked a little bit on it when the translation was made. But there's many details I forgot about married life. But I if I remember well, they Shabtai Tzvi and Nathan of Gaza do a messianic tour through the Holy Land, and Sarah joins them afterwards in Smyrna in Izmir. And one of the things that's happening, so maybe I should go a little bit back, because one of the contrast I'm showing in my book is that there is a meeting of two very different attitudes towards the this worldly life and the other worldly life. And Nathan of Gaza and Shabtai Tzvi came also from that same circle. This was very much a culture of Kabbalists talking in often very highly sexualized terms about the feminine aspect of God. But this sexualized talk was compensated, you can say that, by almost sexual asceticism. So usually, like when people talk about Jews in history and Christians in history, they make a superficial comparison that Christians are very have issues with sexuality and Jews are much more healthy with sexuality. But this is not really the case. There are sexually ascetic traditions in Judaism, even though it's normative to marry, and even though also this Kabbalist, so there's no such thing as monasticism in Judaism. But nevertheless, there is this attitude of sexuality is almost something dangerous. So these were a bunch of men, and Nathan of Gaza was also, that they were sitting together and they were literally repressing their sexuality. Yeah, so and Shabtai Tzvi seemed also to be belonging to this group. And then suddenly you have this woman who is representing almost the opposite. And as I said, the possible second reason for their marriage, that Shabtai Tzvi was going to marry this like woman of the flesh, sexualized, transgressive woman in order to almost punish or redeem. So it doesn't mean that he was attracted to them. But what happens is that as soon as they're in Spina, like you get like other rumors of things going on that are, so Shabtai Tzvi was already doing transgressive behavior, but on the level of sexuality, I don't think you have it before she enters the picture. So then you have stories that a man is supposed to enter her chambers and he runs out in pure fear because he saw what was waiting for him. And then Shabtai Tzvi says like, well, you could have done a great tikkun. So like you it was actually good there. So there's suddenly there's all kinds of stories of sexual activity that you didn't see before. And you see much later also in the Frankist and also the Shabbatines becomes actually part of the Shabbatean tradition. So I suggested that she actually might have an important role in turning around this sexually ascetic, if you talk about sex, it's about the higher spheres and it's symbolical. And she turns this around and she becomes almost this person. Throughout her stay with chapter 3, you see also a clear competition with Nathan of Gaza, and maybe you want to talk about it later. But the two of them really seem to have represented these two very different attitudes of Nathan of Gaza. Also himself wasn't a very transgressive character, but he didn't do any of the weird things, particularly not any of the sexual transgressions. So they were clearly hostile to each other also. Nathan really tried to get rid of her twice, but he was dealing with a more powerful opponent than he expected. So he failed at this. So maybe that's something that we can talk about later. And then, of course, you know the rest of the story. Chapter 3 goes to Constantinople to take the power from the Sultan. This doesn't work out. He's arrested. He's put into a prison. He's been given the choice to convert or to die. He chooses the first. He converts. His wife also converts, but they start to hold a messianic court, basically. They have a very pleasant prison. So because he converts, they become kind of part of the Ottoman court, and we don't know exactly like what the Ottomans wanted to do with them. It might also have been a desire to missionize among the Jews. The things also there, like they go a bit out of hand. The Turks becomes too popular, so they ban him again. And Sarah is also sent to him. He succeeds to divorce her for a short time, probably inspired, plotted by Nathan. But that also doesn't work well. Like he takes her back, and then again, like years are fuzzy after all these years. But I think in 1764. 1674, like she passes away, like 2 years before he does. So that's basically her life. So she really becomes the from a Polish Jewish refugee girl, fighting for survival by making up really good stories and convincing people with this. So she was clearly charismatic, and then later developing also. Skills also in Smyrna, she becomes one of the main prophetesses of the movement, to becoming the queen of the Sabbatean court. So the right hand man or right hand woman of Shabtai Tzvi. So, but it's so interesting that in most of the stories of Shabtai, and it's understandable, like she's not really part of the story because we don't know enough about her, and there's no real. She has no place in the intellectual tradition also of Sabbateanism. So it's hard to, but I also saw this as a challenge. So like we have here the person who is not really speaking, but she really seems to be such an important person there. So how do you write about it? And I know that you should write about it without using question marks, because that's always the most annoying reading, like suggesting with question marks. So, but I do remember when I was writing it that it was very hard to you know that in a sense, like you're filling in the gaps, but you also know that she was an important person. So I think this is in short, maybe not so short, her biography, and of course, like there's also many later versions of her biography, but this is these are the main outlines of her life.
And she did have a son with him, right? She had one child with him.
Yes. But with him, that's the question. So one of the things is so Shabtai Tzvi failed to perform in their first marriages. And again, it's more. I remember once I met Rachel Elior in the cafeteria of the National Library, and I talked to her, and she said, like, you should realize like that this person was probably very traumatized, and that stayed with me. Like she was willing to go far. So if she was with Shabtai Tzvi. And the story had to be that they had consummated their marriage, and they were trying to consummate their marriage. So they might have never been together. So it might have been his son, it might have been somebody else's son. We don't know. So they had a son, but it's not clear if this was his son. But yeah, they did have a son.
Now, something else that you kind of mentioned. I mean, why do others, I mean, Sholem in the beginning, why they don't talk so much about her? Is that because of specific reason Sholem's opinion of her? Was it she just whether it was the lack of sources? I mean, what was the reason for that? That you,
I think both, because we shouldn't do injustice to Sholem. Like, so if you read Sholem well, like he's fascinated by her. So you can see that he really likes her, but then he has to also repress himself. So you can also say that he was able to repress his romanticism and I wasn't. So I felt more that he wanted to go further, because also like her stories, if I remember well, like it's in long footnotes. Like he bans her to the footnotes. But he's really interested in her. But there, Solomon's book is a book. Though on the one hand he makes this psychiatric diagnosis of chapter 3, but overall it's a deeply it's an intellectual book, like describing the movement in terms of the Lurianic Kabbalistic tradition rather than what later persons have done. So my work fits a little bit with that of Matt Goldish and Ada Rappaport-Alwat, which is well, actually we should also look at the big prophetic movement in which women and children were in particular important. And so I think Sholem was like, okay, this is not really the movement. I'm interested in the movement as an intellectual movement. We don't know enough about her. I'm secretly fascinated with this woman, but I'm succeeding to suppress this and ignore her. But you see her coming, because like, he has tremendous amount of sources, so you see her popping up all the time, so you can see how important this is. But yeah, he doesn't feel that he can do anything with her or wants to do anything with her, so he ignores, and Nathan becomes the big, so Nathan is a real husband of chapter 3 in his book, rather than chapter 3 his real wife. So that's the work of Sholem.
Now, one thing that you didn't mention, and maybe you alluded to that we should discuss, is that Nathan was her, you know, didn't like her at all. And there's a prophecy that Nathan prophesied as related to her, and then she had a response to that. So maybe we want to discuss what that was and how she, and what that little episode was.
Yeah, that was a beautiful game of prophetic play and playing against it. So. Again, my memory is as usual very bad, but he at some point he issued a prophecy in which of course the Sultan would submit to chapter 3 and later he would rebel again. But like one of the important things is that in a later stage in the scenario that was going to be played out, chapter 3 would change his wife. Yeah, so he would marry Rivka. I remember like the daughter of Moses, which I still don't understand why. But so he would marry Rivka and his present spouse, not to be named by name, and I'll try to be as offensive as possible, would become a shifra, like a slave or a concubine. So he basically like, He by a prophecy, because like prophecies can be fulfilled, especially if you know the Messiah and can act upon it. So he was kind of suggesting, this is the prophecy. Why don't you act it out and get rid of this woman at some point? But it's also really interesting that he really puts this in a relatively far away future, because still other things are going to happen before. So he didn't think he could get rid of her so quickly as that. But the issue is like Sarah, she fought back. So at some point she started to also sign letters with Rivka. So she basically picked that name, like I transformed from one to the other. So she responded in a way that she adapted and it didn't have any effect. So to my knowledge, nobody demanded, well, we should get rid of that woman because this is what the prophecy says. And also later, like chapter 3 divorces her, and it really seems that Nathan also had his hands in it. And chapter two really wraps it into like, I've been in slavery for years. Like it's like the complaints of a repressed, suppressed husband for years. And he divorces her, and even like there's a new bride on the way, but she dies on the way. So it seems like now he finally got rid of her, and Nathan got rid of her. But like a few years, I forgot like how quickly, but like he takes her back again. So both attempts to get rid of domestic and ex-spouse like were utterly failures. And also, it's important to know, like, so at the Messianic court, and this is when you read history, like those who massage the feet of the king are more important than those who are like sitting far away in castles. So proximity to the Messiah is very important. Nathan was most of the time not there, and who was there was Sarah. So at some point, they were able to get rid of Sarah to banish her. But at most of the period of the Sabbatean court, as I call it, like she was there at the side of him, and of course, like she was able to influence him.
One thing that another thing that you did mention, but I want to just emphasize, you said that, you know, what was her effect on Shabsay and the movement and the other actions that went on there? I mean, you know, there's this whole story that he puts the axe and he bangs into the shul, and he has the woman go read from the Torah. Like there's some weird, I don't know if she's involved with that. And there are other weird stories. Like what kind of effect does she have? I know you discussed some of this before.
Yeah. So one of the effects that might be in it, Ada Rappaport, Albert suggested this, and I think also Shalom has he hints at it, but then he dismisses it, that the place of women in the movement, because chapter 3 gives women a more important place. I'm a bit suspicious of it. I really feel I personally know Sarah, and maybe it's that this because I spend time on her, and it's not fair, but it might not be that she was working on behalf of women. So it's also because chapter 2 was transgressive. So if you want to be transgressive, give women a role that they're not supposed to have. So my feeling was that a more important element of her influence, and it's still like it's not I don't prove it, but I have this, I feel it, this is very convincing. It's what I said before, that she introduces this sexual nature, sexual transgression that becomes, and of course, like it's transgression, but it's regarded as a redeeming activity that becomes central to the movement later. And when you see much later also in the Frankist movement, also there, that the daughter of Frank becomes the Messiah herself. So I think this is very important. This turnaround from kind of a platonic orientation towards the supernatural is more important. And she almost like, and also because of lack of other possibilities, because she cannot be part of the Kabbalist, she cannot be part of the discourse, she brings it down to a more fleshy realm. So I think that's the importance of her role in the movement and her lasting influence afterwards. But again, like this is like I'm stating this with modesty, and anyway, like I feel I should anyway be modest. Like I've been writing this standing on the shoulders of giants, and I think not even coming above their ear. But I felt like this is a plausible possibility that she actually, like her very person, played a role in this shift in the movement.
I mean, how would you then define her place in the movement, her role in the movement, versus how others have? Was she an important figure then in the movement, in your opinion?
Yes, and again, like this is still like we can prove it, and so there's no documentation, but like I think she had an enormous influence on the movement. Yeah, and. Again, like we don't know for sure, but this is what is very likely the case, especially when the moment that she becomes the main person in the court, like you see like things changing, you see the kind of transgressions change in the court.
So, and what was her post-death legacy? What was her legacy after this in the movement and outside?
So in the years afterwards. So first of all, we see that like in the Frankist movement, almost like she is like Eva is almost like the her reincarnation. So that she's important, but she's still like and I'm sure like. I'm sure my colleagues might have found material, but she seems to be disappearing a little bit. And she becomes really interesting again in the 19th century, where you have Jewish academics writing on Jewish history. And there she becomes, and they horribly romanticize her. There she becomes the I'm in a way like maybe that's that I'm their descendant. So becomes the representative of the healthy sexual Judaism versus the monastically oriented unhealthy Christianity. So she starts to play that role, and she also becomes the symbolizing the healthy non-exilic Jew versus the weaker exilic Jew. So you have all these like especially fiction writers who start to write about her, and it's really fascinating. There's one, I think it's Felix Teilhaber, Dein Reich komme, your kingdom comes, and there she looks for redemption of women. Like, yeah, so she's a feminist. And she first goes to Rembrandt. So she's in Amsterdam, and Rembrandt is very disappointing. Then she goes to Spinoza. Spinoza is the great ascetic, so he's not one. So she ends up with chapter 3. So she becomes suddenly like a fascination for writers, even for Sachar Masov, after who sadomasochism is named. So he also write a story about her that she sexually liberates the Messiah and brings him to his true self. So she becomes again like an obsession for Jewish writers, and in a sense she becomes the hero. She becomes the healthy sexual Jew versus the exile or even versus the Christian Jew.
Okay, so very interesting. Now, before we get to other reading, I'm going to ask you about your book. The English one is not available now, is that right? And the Hebrew one, though, Hebrew edition is available. What's the...
No, the English one is available if you can find it. So at the Menachem Ben Israel Institute in Amsterdam, they have a website, and you should be able to get the book there. And the Hebrew one is available, I think, even on Amazon. It has a gorgeous front cover from a wonderful artist, Rui Rosen. So it is available, but it's hard to find.
Right, and as you mentioned, we mentioned it's small. I mean, the English one is around 60 pages plus, and then there's endnotes as well. So it's a small, very nice read. And then the Hebrew one, I think, is a little bigger than that.
Yeah.
Okay, and now what about any other reading relating to? So are there any other articles or books that are suggested?
So I would, of course, like, suggest the three great books, like Sholem's book on Shabbat 3, Matt Goldish, the Sabbatine Prophets, is very important because he's basically part of that movement. So he's giving the other picture. And then Ada Rappaport-Albert's book that came out when I was making my footnotes when it came out. But it's based also on earlier material in Hebrew that I used. I forgot the title, like Women in the Sabbatine Messianic Movement. It came out in 2012, maybe 11. And so that's also a very good book. So these are good works to start with. Yeah, so mine is quite short and focused, and Ada Rappaport-Albert's book really focuses on women in the movement. It's a bit of she describes the movement as it's almost like a emancipatory movement towards women. I'm not completely sure. I think it was much more than that, like to emancipate humanity from our fallen state. And Matt Goldish's book is also very good. It's about the prophetic movement, the showing the other image that Sholem, in a sense, although he describes it in detail, that's the problem with criticizing Sholem, that he does write about it in detail. So you can't really say ignored it. So this is the large messianic movement, and afterwards only the diehards continue. And I sense like in a lot of scholarship, the diehards and the continuing ones become more important, more interesting than the mass movement. That when the Messiah converts to Islam, it dissipates. So therefore, like this is the periphery. I think as Yehuda Leibowitz called it. So they're less important.
Okay, very
good. These are the three books I would recommend.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Yeah, I think they were in the show's notes on the first episode with Matt Goldish, but I can put them below again. I'll include the link to, I'll try if I can find the Menashe Ben Israel Institute link, but I'll definitely put in the Hebrew link. I think it is on Amazon. It's Idra Press, definitely on their website for sure. In Israel, it's available, the Hebrew edition. So I'll try to link to that. And thank you, Professor Vanderhaven, for joining me. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.